Welcome back to the Health Longevity Secrets Show, and I'm your host, Dr. Robert Lufkin. It's not enough for medical researchers to understand the methods of Alzheimer's prevention using lifestyle and other tools. This message must also be delivered to frontline healthcare workers and the public at large. Peggy Sarland loves to bring the power of great storytelling to broadcast, advertising, museums, books, and songs. She has hosted two acclaimed online series on Alzheimer's disease and brain health, garnering more than 4 million views. And she also wrote books that accompany these programs. Peggy is also a singer-songwriter performer who just released her second album. Her website is www.peggysarland.com. And now, please enjoy this interview with Peggy Sarland. Hi, Peggy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Dr. Lufkin. Thank you so much for having me on.
It's so great to be here. I have to say that I'm a fan of your work and the book, this book, Awakening from Alzheimer's, and the programs that you've produced, the educational programs on Alzheimer's disease, I have to say are the best ones I've ever seen. And I send all my patients and anyone interested in Alzheimer's disease, I refer them to your excellent programs. And we'll have the links to those in the show notes. And I can't wait to talk about that. But before we do, I thought maybe we just take a moment and tell us a little bit about sort of your background and how you came to be so interested in this fascinating area.
Well, I'm a writer. I'm a freelance writer. And my publisher, Lee Euler, called me in 2012, and his mother had just passed from Alzheimer's. And because he's in the health market, he's always looking for the alternative remedies, the little known treatments that, mainstream media doesn't know. And he'd just been through this tragic experience with his mother of really nothing that the medical establishment could offer her. And he said, can't we do better? Can you look, is there a book here? So I started to look at this point in my own life. I had absolutely no personal experience with brain problems. And I said to him, I don't know, I'll look. And I started looking. This was 2012. And just to place it in time, in 2014, Dr. Dale Bredesen, who many of us have come to know as just a huge pioneering figure here, in 2014, he published his first study of 10 people. 9 out of 10 improved with his method. But that study hadn't, this was 2012 and I was on my own, I'm not a doctor. And I started poking around and finding, I felt like Columbus discovering a new world. I could not believe how much there was. And so, I could share some examples. One of the first things I found was the story of Dr. Mary Newport and her husband, Steve, and this is now the stuff of legend, but there's so much to the story, I think. So Dr. Newport is a neonatologist, if I said that correctly, in Florida, and her husband had very, very serious early onset Alzheimer's. He was only 57, and he reached a point where he was almost non-functional, and he seemed basically like he was about to die. And she was desperate. She did a little research and found out that there was a medical food that was waiting to be approved, and that its primary ingredient was MCT, medium chain triglycerides, which she knew was in coconut oil. She went to the health food store. She bought a jar of coconut oil. She gave a teaspoon to her husband, Steve, and he said, it's like the light came on. And the rest is kind of history. It's amazing. He was 8 years into it. He lived another 7 years, and they were basically good years. he did lawn work. He read articles from Scientific American. He volunteered in the community because of coconut oil. So I think there's a lot to think about in that story, a lot.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, we've heard other people talk about triglycerides and ketones and ketogenic diet. And I mean, with that knowledge, it makes you wonder why assisted care facilities all over aren't routinely just adding MCT oils to the food. I mean, it's what could it hurt? And you know, the benefit that this message isn't getting out there. It's amazing. Well, maybe you could tell us a little bit about after speaking to all these experts, you've immersed yourself in this area. How do you visualize Alzheimer's disease? What is it?
Well, the main thing, again, yeah, most references come back to Dr. Bredesen because he's really defined this area so beautifully. But even going back to the doctors I was speaking to in 2012, there was the same feeling. This is multifactorial. There's many things, and you come in multiple ways. And it's not hardly ever one thing. It's several things. And it's amazing if you know to look for them, how empowered you can be. I mean, the primary thing to understand is that this is possible. You can do something and you can change the whole trajectory of this by keeping on trying, coming at it from different angles. And that is really, rather than waiting for the perfect pharmaceutical pill to come along and just passively waiting, it's actively improving your health in many different ways. I mean, to give an example, I spoke to a doctor, Pamela Wardian Smith. She told me she had a 67-year-old patient who showed up to her office 4 hours late because she'd been driving around for 4 hours getting lost. And she only lived a few blocks away, but she was that disoriented at age 67. So Dr. Smith looked her over and she found out, wait a second, she's got a lousy diet. She's not sleeping. She's very low in B12. And her memory hormone, which I'm going to attempt to pronounce pregnenolone, something like that. Yeah. Is so low that it was undetectable. So, you know, what is the cause of her dementia? It's all those things. You have to do all of them. You can't, if you raise her, if you optimize her hormones, but she's still not sleeping, she's still eating a lousy diet. It's all of them together. So this woman, the 67-year-old woman, Sally, recovered enough. She's now 80, and she's running a 5-star restaurant with her son. She went into business with her son. So that story kind of typifies to me the potential if you address it in many ways.
Yeah. So Alzheimer's disease, I guess, is very challenging because it is so multifactorial. Like if you think about it, of all the major chronic diseases that we face, you know, heart attack, stroke, even cancers, the medical system has come up with some type of at least initial treatments. But for Alzheimer's disease, as you pointed out, there is no drug that reduces the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. And this is literally despite the greatest minds in science and medicine working on it for 30 years with essentially a blank check and unlimited financial resources.
Yeah, so, exactly. Exactly.
And yet the answer appears to be right in front of our noses that with lifestyle changes and identifying, as we'll talk about, toxins and other factors and hormone imbalances, by just identifying these things, we can actually prevent or reverse Alzheimer's disease and certainly halt its progression, I guess. I'm wondering, why aren't people shouting this from the rooftops? Why is there such resistance from the healthcare establishment to deliver this message? I don't feel it's politicized like some of the COVID things are. It doesn't make sense. What's your take on it?
It's so frustrating. If we go back to the Dr. Newport story, she had this unbelievable discovery. She was there so early. She tried to tell doctors about it. She couldn't get anybody to listen to her. She and her sister would fly to medical conferences. They wouldn't let them in, but they'd stand in the hallway and hand out literature. There was such resistance to this. And speaking, you know, a very common theme of the doctors whom I have interviewed is tremendous frustration with their colleagues who just don't seem to be curious about finding things that are working. And this is why programs like this, the work I'm trying to do, others are trying to do, I mean, eventually it's got to be groundswell as more people hear it, as more caregivers hear it and go to the doctors and say, look into this, you know. It's so frustrating. You mentioned the drug, you know, why keep doing things the same way? You mentioned all the money, billions of dollars spent in drugs, but all the drugs have taken the same approach. It doesn't matter. They all take the same approach of let's get rid of the amyloid plaque in the brain. But that's conclusively the wrong approach. None of them work. You can get rid of the plaque and it doesn't get you better because the plaque is there performing some kind of a protective purpose to some kind of insult, and you need to find the insult. So I think there's a lot of frustration that the medical establishment hasn't been a bit more curious.
It's almost as if our healthcare establishment, and by healthcare establishment, I speak as a product of that. I've spent 30 years in a medical school teaching, and I still am at a medical school teaching. But it seems like our healthcare delivery system, as it is optimized for a pill or a prescription. I can write an insulin prescription in 30 seconds, but in order to counsel the patient, instruct them how to remove carbohydrates from their diet, and then not need insulin at all as a type 2 diabetic, that would take longer than the 7 minutes I'm allocated for the interview. And it seems like the lifestyle changes that are at the root for reversing many of the causes of Alzheimer's, not all of them, the toxic and the, you know, some of the hormones and deficiencies we'll talk about, but the lifestyle changes, at least, it's going to require rethinking how the healthcare system works and re-incentivizing somehow to fully embrace this. Even lifestyle itself sort of has a bad name. When people think lifestyle, there's so many conflicting opinions about just, you know, eat well and exercise more. There's still a lot of disagreement on what eating well is. Although I think for Alzheimer's disease, there's a consensus about, you know, ketogenic diets and all, but it's frustrating, as you say, that with our colleagues, that this message isn't getting out because people are dying and people are being harmed because of it every day.
I have kind of a perfect example of the difference between the two approaches, because my book, Awakening from Alzheimer's, came out in 2012, and a woman named Deborah Glasper read it. She was a caregiver for her mother. And when I updated the book in 2016, I spoke to her, and she told me she started using the recommendations in the book on her mother, who was at this point 91. The mother lived with her. The mother could make her bed. The mother could help with the cooking. The mother could play Scrabble. The mother had a good time. everything was good, right? The mother's sisters, Alzheimer's ran very strongly in this family. The grandmother had died of it. The mother's sisters, all of them had Alzheimer's. And they were all going to conventional doctors and getting the Aricept. And they were all declining. They were all rapidly declining. And her mother, who was following these recommendations, was holding steady and having a great time and enjoying her life in 91. So there's the difference. It's right there, because it's the difference between her and her sisters. There's a genetic component, and you see the contrast.
What do you think needs to happen to get the message out? Is it just, what do we need to do?
I think what you're doing is great. And I'm going to be doing hopefully another series. I'm planning that now, and a podcast as well. I'm becoming a health coach. By the time this is on, I'll be a certified health coach. And I plan to work to help people with their cognitive health. I'm at the Institute for Integrative Nutrition. And the founder of that, Josh Rosenthal, says he founded this because he wants a ripple effect. I mean, the whole lifestyle, unfortunately, modernity seems to be a problem. The modern world seems to be toxic. So we've got a problem there. But his vision of health coaches is that it's a ripple effect. You know, you learn and then you improve, and your family and your friends and your clients, and they go. And so I think that's all we can do, is actively try to teach other people what we know.
What are you learning at the health coaching program, and how does it mesh with what you know about preventing and reversing Alzheimer's disease? Is there a consistency there?
There is a consistency there. I didn't even know what a health coach was. And I first heard about it when I was interviewing Dr. Bredesen, who said the future of healthcare is health coaches. And I said, what's a health coach? And a health coach is a coach who helps you reach your health goals, you know, and that's kind of simple. But it comes up again and again what doctors see. Patient comes, you give them this beautiful program, and here's, you know, you're going to eat this diet, and you're going to go to sleep at 10 o'clock at night, and you're going to do cardio five times a week. And it's just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful suggestions. And then, unfortunately, the patient is not compliant, right? That's the one problem. They don't do it. So the missing link can be that health coach, because I'm going to be working with people in a 6-month program, talking to them twice a month and say, okay, let's talk about your health. You know, the doctor, you know, you're a busy doctor. You're not going to sit there for an hour and say, okay, tell me your bedtime routine. You know, how long are you with the computer? Do you have blue blocking glasses that you wear? When do you stop drinking coffee? You know, you're not going to do that. The coach is going to take the time to really work with you on your whatever is, why aren't you compliant? You know, you want to feel better. The coach is going to kind of probe around and help you find what works with you. So that's one part of it. What are your thoughts about compliance? It's tricky, right? Getting people.
Yeah, I think a health coach is a great idea. And I agree with what Dr. Bredesen said. That's the future of healthcare, because all these chronic diseases are at their root based on lifestyle changes for many patients, not all, but many patients. And once you fix the toxicities and the deficiencies, even Alzheimer's can benefit from these lifestyle changes. But it's like you say, you can't hand somebody a note in 5 minutes and have them change their entire life to live healthier. It needs, quite frankly, it needs to be taught in the schools, you know, when in lunch programs.
Let's not talk about what student lunches look like. Let's not talk about what they serve in the cafeteria. What are they doing to these kids? You know, what are they doing? What are they doing to these kids? Yeah. They're filling them up with the chemicals in this processed food. You know, and setting them up for problems in the future.
Absolutely. The coaching, I think, is a wonderful way to do that. Tell me about your program. How long was it? And what was the experience like for you?
Well, I took it's normally a year. I took an accelerated version, 6 months, compiled on the work, because I really want to get down to it. And I want to share with you a concept of how they teach, which is that there's primary foods and secondary foods. And the secondary foods are food. The secondary foods are what you eat. And of course, we could talk about that for the next 100 hours. But that, nevertheless, in importance, they place that second. And here, the primary foods are here. I'm going to hold it up. I don't know if you'll see it. Circle of life. The circle of life with different aspects that contribute to health. And you work with your clients on how are you doing in all these different aspects? Because if one of them is out of balance, your health is going to get out of balance. I mean, maybe, you know, going back to brain health, maybe you're having trouble sleeping. Well, why aren't you sleeping? Because you're anxious. Well, what are you anxious about? Maybe it's some. So I'll read you what's here on the circle of life. On the top, your spirituality. And for me personally, that's at the top in my own life too. If I've maybe later we'll talk about just personally what I've been going through. I've had the most brutal decade. Just had a hideously difficult decade. And I couldn't get through it without spirituality. And I do just want to say the standard thing that doctors say is meditate. And maybe you could talk about from your imagery of the brain, maybe you can tell us what meditation does to the brain that they recommended so highly. But for me, I just have never been that interested in meditating. For me, spirituality is prayer. That's what it is. It's studying, reading, you know, reading Bible every morning, reading commentary on it, studying it and praying. And that's how if that weren't in tune, nothing would be in tune personally. So do you have any thoughts about because, you know, you look at imagery, what is it? Why are doctors so excited about recommending meditation?
Well, from the imaging side, there aren't a lot of changes on the medical imaging or the radiology of the brain, at least with MR and CT, because those are very gross things. There's more changes with like blood oxygenation studies and functional type studies,
right?
There,
I see.
But there's a lot of interest in it for stress reduction and emotional regulation and overall well-being, even if
Clearly.
It doesn't show up on the scan.
Even if it doesn't show up on the scan. Okay, spiritual net, creativity. Now, creativity for me, a lot of it as, I'm also a singer-songwriter and put out 2 albums, Friends and Family and Let There Be Love. I only record my own songs. So for me, dealing with the difficulties of life, I need to express it creatively. But creativity isn't just, you know, that you paint or you, you know, you write or an approach to life is simply bringing, I mean, you're doing this summit and bringing your creativity. It's creative to do this. It's, you know, I think people shouldn't feel boxed in that at the end of it, you know, you've taken up glass blowing. I mean, maybe you have, and that's wonderful, but it's an approach to life, a freshness, a lack of rigidity, I think.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, for Alzheimer's disease, having that stimulation and that spark and that passion, just brain activity is a great thing.
It's a great thing to keep your brain alive so you don't develop it, because you're constantly being creative. Finances, I think we all know that not having finances in order are very stressful. That is certainly something that has to be attended to. And given the world we're in right now with all the repercussions of COVID, many people are struggling with this. And so clearly this is a big part of life.
And with finances, there's an interesting paper that just came out that showed the financial scores that people generate. When their financial scores deteriorate over time, it's an independent risk factor for Alzheimer's disease and cognitive decline. In other words, before anything, patients can have trouble with their finances, and that can be a bellwether that things are happening with them.
Yeah, for instance, in going back to the Dr. Mary Newport story, her husband Steve was an accountant who managed her medical practice. And when he began, you know, the accountant stopped paying bills and made mistakes in the taxes and so forth. This is an indication. So that is an early indication. Career. I think we all know career is a huge part of your life. Either it's not satisfying or it's very satisfying, but it's so demanding that everything else is out of balance. It's taking you away from other things you need to sustain health. So getting that career in a proper balance is essential for brain health. I mean, it just is. Education. There are studies that people who are well educated are less prone to Alzheimer's, or even from autopsies, they may even have had Alzheimer's, but they never showed it because there was so much resilience in their brain. There's so much synaptic density from that they overcame it. You know, but education to me isn't necessarily degree, it's lifelong learning. People who are watching your summit right now are educating themselves and helping their brains that way through the process of learning new information, right? As I am going back and becoming a health coach, you know. Health, well, that's kind of everything we're talking about, but I do want to highlight the importance of sleep in there, because maybe that's something you see as a doctor as well. It's maybe underappreciated how important it is.
Absolutely. And it's for Alzheimer's disease, disordered sleep can be a very strong driver of the disease.
And talking to my friends about it, because I've begun, you know, as a health coach, kind of just talking to them about their health, I see very often that people who want to accomplish things and there's too much to do in a day, they try to regard sleep as optional. It's like you're weak if you give in to sleep. It's kind of a driven person's attitude, but it isn't optional. It's utterly destructive to your health to ignore your sleep.
Absolutely.
Next one, physical activity. Well, why don't you take this away as a doctor, the importance of this?
Sure. I mean, even as a radiologist, the findings we see with Alzheimer's disease, we've talked about in the summit before, but atrophy of a part of the brain called the hippocampus, where it gets smaller, where the memories are in not only people with Alzheimer's, but also at risk for Alzheimer's disease. It's been shown that with exercise, there's something called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF.
Yes, BDNF.
And that stimulates brain growth, particularly in the hippocampus. And on the MR scans, I never thought I would see this, but you can actually see reversal of the atrophy and improvement, the hippocampus growing back essentially when people are put in these strong exercise programs, and their Alzheimer's improves as well.
Well, that's the kind of thing that, you know, you raised about why doesn't the profession know this? How many doctors, how many neurologists, how many psychiatrists, how many geriatricians actually know that you can increase hippocampal volume, that it's actually possible for the hippocampus to grow larger through physical exercise? I mean, there's still this very doomed outlook of there's nothing you can do, there's nothing you can do. I mean, you see it in your imagery.
Yeah, I mean, I think the value and the impact of lifestyle on this condition is greatly underappreciated by my colleagues and the people I know in this space. It's like lifestyle, well, you know, whatever, you know, lose
whatever.
Weight, exercise, you know, you always throw that in. But what we're learning and what we're hearing in this summit and elsewhere in the scientific research, that lifestyle is actually foundational. And without the correct lifestyle, nothing else works. Even all the treatments and drugs and surgery will still fail if the appropriate lifestyle isn't in place at the most basic level. And by lifestyle, I mean, you know, nutrition, exercise, sleep, stress.
Stress, yeah.
All these things.
The key things. You know, you brought up the subject of medications. We still have some more spokes of the wheel here on the Circle of Life.
Yeah, yeah.
While I'm thinking of it, I do want to talk about medications for a minute, because that was one of the first things I learned. Both Dr. Ronald Hoffman, whom I spoke to, and Dr. Jacob Teitelbaum, who's one of my favorite guys to talk to because he's very candid in his opinion of the medical establishment and doesn't mince words. But they both raised the topic of the medications themselves being an issue. You can have elderly people on 20 different medications. I heard about somebody yesterday on 43 medications. I mean, wow. This is just unbelievable. So the medications themselves can be an issue. And first of all, maybe they're interacting. Who knows when you're on 20 medications like that? And then common medications many people listening may be taking can in fact be detrimental to the brain. I mean, the most famous one may be statins.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the most amazing things I've been learning about since becoming involved in this space and learning about metabolic disease and lifestyle is something, a term I never learned in medical school, and it's called deprescribing, where a person who's on prescription medications is actually, they're deprescribed and they're taken off those medications. And for a lot of the metabolic abnormalities that underlie things, when those are returned to normal through lifestyle, frequently people go off statins, they go off hypertensive, anti-hypertensive drugs. And it's really remarkable to see the drugs are removed with appropriate healthy lifestyle choices.
That's perfect. You said it perfectly. And that is one of the first things I learned when I was investigating this in 2012. Work with a doctor and see if maybe you can cut down some of those drugs, and maybe you can eventually go off some of them, because the drugs that, you know, Dr. Teitelbaum said, you know, you get on a drug and then you never get off it. Maybe you started it 20 years ago. Do you still need it? Does anybody know? You know, so having a fresh look at medications can be very, very helpful part of kind of clearing out the cobwebs in the brain, you know. So should we keep going with the
absolutely.
Our spokes on the wheel? Next one is home cooking. So how many people, you know, you eat out at a restaurant, or you know, take out and it's processed and there's sugar and there's chemicals, and there's a satisfaction from home cooking, and there's also an empowerment that you know exactly what's going into it. So that can be, and it can be very simple. It doesn't have to be complicated at all what you cook, but just making most of your meals in your own kitchen can be a very big step towards health.
Yeah, I love it. That's a great concept.
Doesn't make sense. Home environment. If you're living in a home that is noisy, where there's pollution coming through the window, where there's neighbors that scream at you, where there's clutter everywhere. And as soon as you walk in, you think, oh my God, I left the laundry. Creating a peaceful environment that supports your health is a very good thing to do for yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And with home environment, I'd add one more thing, which is mold, with dampness and mold. It can, of course, mold, the mycotoxins from the mold can be a cause of cognitive impairment and drive Alzheimer's disease. So yeah, the home environment is very important.
Very important. Well, the mold, Dr. Bredesen's work has showed that was, he said just one of the biggest surprises is what a huge percentage of people with Alzheimer's had a mold problem in their home and weren't aware of it. And I just want to add to that, what we know about mold now is there may be mold in your home and it manifests differently. So the wife may get Alzheimer's, the husband may get asthma, but it's just the mold is attacking where they are weak. And so it's bad for your health. And so, yes, having a toxic, free, and pleasant home environment, important. Next spoke on our, we're getting just a few more here. Relationships.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Relationships. I just want to say, because I'll get to the next one, I'm going to wrap them up in a bow together. Relationships, social life, and joy. To me, those are all very related. And when this lockdown started, when this lockdown was imposed from on high, I went, what is going to happen to people's brains? I mean, isolation and loneliness is one of the biggest risk factors for Alzheimer's. And we were forcing people to be lonely. The stimulation of doing new things and meeting new people and going, and talked about spirituality, going to church. Think of all the things church does. You go to church. It's not just your spirituality. You're seeing people. You're meeting people. One of the doctors, Dr. Vincent Fortinace, told me that many, many people tell him the only time they ever feel the touch of another human being when they get elderly is when they shake somebody's hand at church. And just touching another person is good for your brain as well. It releases serotonin and all, we're meant to be in contact. And yeah. So relationships, social life, and joy are under particular attack right now from this social situation, and there's no easy answers for this.
Absolutely. You mentioned you wanted to share some moments from your personal life with us here.
Yeah, well, as I said, when I got into learning about the brain and working on the brain, it was completely intellectual work. It had nothing to do with me personally. I didn't know a single person affected by it. But unfortunately, the year it was published, 2012, shortly after it came out, my husband had a massive stroke that left him permanently disabled. And he was 6'4". So having a 6'4" paralyzed person to deal with is, I don't wish it on my worst enemy. And it was very tough. And I had to put him I was caring for him at home for a long period of time. And then I put him in a nursing home. You mentioned, why don't they give MCT? I used for him the things that I learned, and I was trying to feed him the healthy foods and to give him supplements that I thought would be helpful, and taking him to doctors who gave him remedies that aren't well known, like rhodiola, adaptogens and things like this. So we did the best we could, but he was in the nursing home for 7 years. And then I'm just going to quickly skip over this so I don't cry, because I don't want to get caught too much in, because it's recent. He passed away in January. Our governor, I live in New York, Governor Cuomo put in COVID patients into the nursing homes. And many people lost their lives as a result of that. My husband, with that going into the story too much eventually, passed away from the after effects of that. It's been really, really tough. And I've needed to take care of my own brain during this, because stress just eats away at the brain. Unmanaged stress is unbelievably corrosive to health, including brain health.
And especially for caregivers, when we're focusing on taking care of someone else, we may overlook things in ourselves, and we need the caregivers need to be strong and take care of themselves as well. It's so important.
Well, I feel so grateful that I had learned this information. I mean, it was a job, you know, it was a writing job, but I feel like it saved my life. I mean, I don't know how I could, I mean, I'm in good shape. I'm resilient. I'm managing through all these just horrible, horrible things I've been dealing with. Because I do try. Dr. Daniel Amen was one of the doctors I interviewed, and he said he kind of teaches his kids almost at every minute, is this good for my brain? Is this bad for my brain? You know, everything that comes along, is this good for my brain? Is this bad for my brain? That's not a normal way people think. But I've trained myself to do that. So even like, for instance, I just said to you now, I'm going to tell this part of the story quickly because I don't want to get sucked down into the emotion. It's like, I don't want to do that to myself. I just don't want to go into all those emotions. So I just kind of sped over it. That's an example. But certainly how I eat and, you know, all the self-care stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What, you mentioned you're working on a new program, educational program that's going to be coming out. It is that something you can talk about yet, or is that still?
It's a little too early. Yeah, it's a little too early, and there'll also be podcasts. But I want to keep updating because I think that the story, you know, what's happened since 2012 when this book was published, as far as I know, is the first book to claim that Alzheimer's can be reversed. So much has happened. And one of those things is, we keep coming back to Dr. Bredesen. It's not just that he has published two studies now, or three studies, and written books that have been bestsellers. His current book is called The First Alzheimer's Survivors. So there it is right there. But he's trained hundreds of doctors in his method. So there are now so many doctors who know this, and they're a resource for you. You can look up, you know, Bredesen protocol doctor in your area. And so that's an example. And then every doctor who knows about this is now fine tuning it. And another, you're going to be speaking to Dr. Heather Sanderson. There's another resource. She's opened up the first residential home, Marama, designed for Alzheimer's patients to live in temporarily. So using these methods, their brain health can be restored and they can go back and live independently. Hey, there's a resource that wasn't there before.
That's remarkable. Yeah, that's such a great concept that these are Alzheimer's patients that are going there temporarily to get better, and then they return to their lives. Wow.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, it's so great. Yeah. And then, of course, there's more and more kind of devices. People may have heard of Brain HQ, a game you can play online that's very, very highly regarded. It was developed by an extremely eminent neuroscientist. So that's something you can do. There's an app called Brain Tap, which you can use for sleep and for stress and other things. And there's a device you can get to go along with it that does light therapy as well. There's just more and more and more stuff out there. for you to use. And so I want to keep on top of all this and keep people updated about what the latest thinking is and what are the latest resources.
Yeah, we'll have a link to your podcast down below too. So when will that start?
Probably not till 2022. So, but in the meantime, people can go to, you can get my book at Amazon, which is just chock full of good information, such as we've been talking about, Awakening from Alzheimer's. And you can go, you can write to me if you want through my website, peggystarlin.com. You can write to me there, peggystarlin.com. And
well, as an expert in this area, after talking to all these folks in the field, I have to ask you, what, if you're comfortable sharing, what your personal lifestyle choices are and how are they informed by what you've learned by going through this whole journey?
Well, let's talk about nutrition, because we talked about, you know, this is the primary plate, is things like this.
Yes.
What's the secondary plate, which is actually food, you know? And what I found for me, we've heard now the Dr. Newport story was kind of the introduction to the concept that fats, the right kind of fats, can be very healthy for the brain. And many doctors are still absolutely terrified of the very word fat, as are many dietitians and nutritionists. But there are various principles that have come out that are accepted more recently from people in this space, such as lots of healthy fats. So I do eat, you know, olive oil, coconut, you know, I cook food in olive oil and coconut oil and grass-fed butter and eat salmon and avocado and nuts and seeds, things like that, that we were terrified of, you know, sardines. I have a lot of sardines. Another important aspect of eating that is more mainstream in our kind of circles is restricted time eating. So I'll try to stop eating 3 hours before bedtime, help you get into a deeper sleep. So your body isn't dual tasking of sleeping and all the stuff it has to do. Your body has a busy schedule when you're sleeping, has a lot of cleanup work to do and other things to do. It doesn't have to digest and do the cleanup work at the same time. So stop eating 3 hours before, if you're gonna go to bed at 11, stop eating at 8. And then I basically skip breakfast. I try to keep that fast going. Have coffee with a tiny little bit of cream or a little bit of coconut oil in there. But keep it going, because the longer you keep that fast going, the more you're creating ketones and the more you're letting your body just clean out the toxins, and just do the housekeeping work. That's something people have been talking to you about, doctor, is that time-restricted eating?
Yes. We're seeing the benefits of that with autophagy and also switching into ketosis a little bit, depending on how long the fast is.
Right. And it sounds hard when you're, you know, in the beginning, you think, how can I live without breakfast? That's crazy. And we're always like, breakfast is the most important meal of the day. Breakfast is the most. In fact, it's fine. Once you get into the hang of it, I don't even want to eat breakfast. I'm not hungry. Once your body adjusts to that. And so speaking of, you know, this, what do you actually eat? I find for me, what works the most is it's got to be a high fiber diet. That's what really fills me up. And what I find is learning about the microbiome has been crucial, because your microbiome, the in your gut brain connection, that you want everything to just be perfect there. You don't want leaky gut. You know, you need biodiversity in the gut. You need your microbiome to be well populated with different characters. I think of it as like a town, and electricians are wonderful, but you can't have a whole town of just electricians. you need plumbers and doctors and bus drivers and everybody else. So how do you populate it? So I try to put, like, when I make a salad, it's not just lettuce, tomato, and cucumbers the way the salads we all grew up with. You know, I cut up an apple, I put in flax seeds, I put in chia seeds, I put in hemp hearts, I put in nuts, I chop up some leftover chicken from last night. And I just put as much as I can in there. It's intensely filling. It's just a different way of eating. To me, that is the number one thing I do. I broke my scale about 2 years ago. And so I never step on a scale. I don't worry about it. I just eat this way and you just now get full. So that's one of the most important things I do.
That's great. Yeah, it's certainly working. You're so busy with so many projects going and everything. I mentioned in the introduction that you've just released your second album. Congratulations. When can we expect the third one?
That would be nice. Wouldn't that be great? Well, kind of COVID slowed down the momentum of music and a lot of other things, but you know, music is so good for the brain. Music is so, you know, can you talk from medical imaging? It's my understanding. I mean, that music is in the deepest part. I mean, even Alzheimer's patients who've lost so much function, if you sing to them a song from their childhood, it will be in there and they will light up because it's so deep. Can you speak to that from
absolutely. And while listening to music is very powerful, as you say, because it can trigger the memories and everything, what's even more powerful and what's suggested, if possible, is to actually perform the music or at least sing along with it, because then you're engaging more active parts of your brain. So music's great anyway, but even better if you sing along with the song that you're doing.
I love to sing. And that ties into the creativity, because writing a song, I filmed the whole circuitry lighting up there, just the thinking about it, the singing, calculate that melody, no, do it that way, this lyric, no, that lyric, physically singing, the breath, the pen, writing down the lyrics I'm thinking about. Oh, I feel so alive. It is so... music is, and writing and being creative, creatively responding to life is just, it's just kind of some kind of ultimate health, you know, ultimate vitality.
Yeah, absolutely. We've the members of the audience who want to follow your album or also hear about your podcast or the new program that you're putting together can find that all on the website
I'll update it. So go to peggysarland.com and also feel free to write me there if you're interested in working with me as a health coach or anything else. Peggysarland.com I'd love to hear from you. And I wish everybody in the audience, I wish you a wonderful, high-functioning, long-lasting brain. Because your brain's in charge of everything else that happens. So we all need it.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again, Peggy, for spending an hour with us today. It was great to hear about all the wonderful things you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Doctor. Thank you.
No. This is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking of it because of something you have seen here. If you find this to be of value of you, please hit that like button and subscribe to support the work we do on this channel. Also, we take your suggestions and advice very seriously. Please let us know what you'd like to see on this channel. Thanks for watching, and we'll hope to see you next time.